I did mention to you that the archives of the late and legendary Irish actor Richard Harris have been donated to University College Cork. And that college is actually home to one of Ireland's leading film schools. I'm delighted to say that I am joined by two people who are going to talk to us. Number one, about the archive itself. And number two, about Richard Harris, a fellow Limerick man. So I'm always interested in what Richard Harris was up to, his life and his times. Let me introduce you to our two guests. Cronan O'Devlin is the head of collections at University College Cork. Cronan, you're very welcome to the programme and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. I'm looking forward to hearing about the collections and in particular the Richard Harris one. And also Barry Monaghan is, Barry, you're an academic, but you're an expert on Richard Harris.
Yes, and I've been interested in his career and his general approach to life for a long time, even before and during my early academic work and research. He's always been a fascinating character.
What was it? What is it about Richard Harris that's so fascinating for you?
Well, I suppose the most interesting thing, as I was kind of becoming aware of how film works and my own interest as a teenager in film, as that began to grow, you know, various personalities appear on the landscape. And one of those was Richard Harris in his performance in The Field. There was something that only a younger mind won't appreciate to the same extent. But I do remember that I came away from my experience of that film not only really liking the film, but remembering that it was one of the first performances that I had seen on screen where I didn't come away saying, wow, he's a great actor. I was immediately caught up in the role. Mm. And I began to realize that sometimes we say this about actors on screen and on stage, and in a way that the seeing the art happening isn't quite the same as experiencing the personality directly, and that Harris brought that penetrating personality through the screen. And it was just strange. And then I began to look into other films that he had been in. And the more I learned about him, the more captivated I was by the actor and then the man as I got to know more about him. But that was long before I started studying film formally.
Mm. A film like The Field, to watch it in your 20s or early 30s, is it a different film when you watch it in your 50s or 60s?
I think so. And I think every great film and every great performance will be different as you get older. Probably in a very similar way to the development of performers across their career. They become different people and their experiences become extra stuff in their professional basket. And I think, again, in terms of Richard Harris's career, this was incredibly important because he put so much of who he was into each performance, so that it was probably quite unlikely that he could have played Professor Dumbledore in his 20s or 30s, no more than he could have played the Bull McCabe then. And I think that was really something that was a part of who he was and what he did as an artist. He exposed himself in a very vulnerable way as he performed other characters by bringing his personality and experience to the role. So definitely the same is true for a viewer who's growing and changing and taking all of those experiences on board as well.
Okay. I want to talk to Cronan, if I can, please, about the collection itself. As head of collections, I presume this is something that you're terribly excited about, having all of this together in one place.
Absolutely, Chair. It's an absolutely amazing collection. And I think Barry would agree with me that when we initially viewed the collection, we were astounded just at the scope of it, the size of it, the extent and the range of unexpected material that was included in the archive. For example, you know, the very fact that it covers the entirety of his acting career is an amazing thing in itself. There are about 500 vintage photographs from the various films that he appeared in, a lot of them from the early work that he done, including we think his first publicity photographs or portraits that he had made when he arrived in London. So from the very earliest point of his acting career right up until the Harry Potter films, and the collection is essentially closed out with a very sweet note from Daniel Radcliffe written to him when he was essentially in hospital at the end of his life, wishing him all the best, you know. So it's really an extent. It's very broad, and he, like Horace, definitely you can imagine the busy life that he led and all of the sort of publicity material and bump that is sort of surrounds, you know, filmmaking and film promotion. So he didn't retain absolutely everything that was involved in his career, but he retained a lot of the things that were most important to him. For example, there is a telegram from his father that was sent in 1956 to wish him luck on perhaps one of his first appearances on the London stage. And we know he hadn't, a great relationship with his father. There was some regrets for Horace in that relationship. So obviously that was something that was very, very important to him. And maybe listeners may not be familiar with what a telegram looks like, but it's sort of a precursor to email and text and all of those things. It's printed on exceptionally fragile paper, and you know he purposely kept it inside another really unusual item, which is an unperformed or at least an unknown draft manuscript for a play that he perhaps had intended to direct. So there's a really magnificent range of material in terms of his career. But, you know, you being a Limerick man, you will know of how important he is to Limerick. Mm. And there's also an extensive body of photographs relating to his early life in Limerick, in his family circle and his interests, his sporting interests in rugby and in tennis, and a little bit about life at Kilkee, etc., as well, where people obviously spent their summer holidays. So it's really extensive, and obviously there are artifacts like the crown from Camelot, his golden globes, and the cufflinks that he was awarded for the Palme d'Or, which Barry, myself, and Jared uncovered as we unpacked some of the boxes not so many days ago, which, again, was a surprise to all three of us. So
brilliant. And Jared, obviously, is his son and has been a big part of this. Again, Cronon, I know you can't do this, but if you could put that collection into a box and put it on the shelf, what other boxes would be on the same shelf? What have you got?
Okay, well, the collections in UCC extend from the 12th century to the 21st century. So we are a regional university, and we collect material primarily relating to the region of Munster. We have our oldest item is a manuscript fragment called the Regensburg Fragment, and it derives from the 12th century. It is related to a monastic settlement in Germany, Regensburg in Germany, which was actually established by monks from the Munster region. And we know that because there's a litany of saints that they would have probably sung at services, and the saints' names are all Munster names. So it's a very well known fact that the Irish missionaries were very important from essentially the 9th century on in re-evangelizing Europe after the collapse of the Roman Empire. So that's a very important early item that we have in the collection. We also have the Great Book of Ireland, which is a modern vellum manuscript and contains the work of over 260 Irish and international artists, including the last handwritten words of Samuel Beckett. Wow. Handwritten text of punishment by Seamus Heaney. So we have very extensive collections in terms of literary, but also Munster history. Collections like the Horace collection. We also have the Sean O'Riordan collection, which is an active, creative collection. So that means that it's used quite frequently by filmmakers, by musicians, by the O'Riordan family themselves. So it would contain copies of all of the Areta scores. And of course, Sean Areta was very, very important in cultural heritage in Ireland in establishing Irish traditional music in a modern performance environment that we know so well in terms of the chieftains and all of the traditional music groups that followed in their wake. And you may also be aware that we had a very important recent donation of a Gaelic manuscript from the 15th century, the Book of Lismore, which was in the possession of the Dukes of Devonshire up until just before the pandemic. And it was donated, very, very graciously donated to the library. Lismore is about maybe 40 minutes away from Cork. And the Book of Lismore contains essentially a compendium of literature, international literature in Gaelic, and would have been in the ownership of the McCarthy Rays, who were an aristocratic family, Gaelic aristocratic family in the region at that particular time. So again, a really broad range of material in the collections. Some people may also be aware of photographer John Minahan. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned Samuel Beckett. We have the John Minahan archive. John is famous, of course, for photographing Samuel Beckett on numerous occasions. But we have the entire Minahan archive and also the Alan McWheeney photographic archive, which would include very well-known photographs of Irish travellers from the 1960s. So really, we focus very much on a regional responsibility in a national context. But, you know, obviously Richard Harris is a very, very important part of our Munster heritage as well.
It seems that in death, his archives are in better company than he was often in life. but that's the way it goes sometimes, isn't it? Barry, can I go back to you, please, and just ask you in terms of, Cronan was saying that you were going through the archive and looking at the material, and you know, there were some surprises there for you. You would have known a certain amount about Richard Harris, quite a lot, I'm sure. But as you thumbed your way through the various items that you found, or that were presented to you by Gerard, what did you learn new? What jumped out at you as saying, I never knew that?
Yeah, there were two things, and one of them is about the overall project, because Cronan was taking my hand through this because I'd never worked on the acquisition of this kind of collection before, and boy was I thrown in the deep end. But the first was that, you know, the perception of the still photograph or the still image or the still handwriting on a page gathered in an archive gives you a sense of it being a still place, a safe space where not too much movement can happen. But actually, it is the most dynamic, organically unfolding intellectual and creative experience that can happen at every stage. So in terms of getting the collection and going through it, all of the excitement in terms of the things we just didn't know, and there's also the things you don't know you don't know. Mm-hmm. And that was just unbelievable. And so there are things we knew he had or he owned, but there's absolutely no evidence that they exist until they appear. And we were there when Jared discovered the cufflinks from Cannes, which was a major thing for me, because the cufflinks from Cannes, just to give you a little background on them, you know, it's well known in the film and cinema world that when you're giving somebody a Grammy or an Oscar or a BAFTA, the most important thing is that they're big, heavy pieces of metal. These aren't just shells. And the idea is that it looks great when somebody is given it and they kind of, you know, flinch under the weight. Well, you see, the way French do business in such a classy way is that they will not go after the big heavy metal. They'll give a delicate little filigree thing, and it's the award that matters. It's the token. And now, apparently, Jared was telling us when Richard got this on stage for the best actor performance in This Sporting Life, he said, "Where's my award?" You know, he was disgusted at this little flimsy thing in a beautifully presented box. So there was a story there already, but absolutely no sense that it was going to be extant. So as we were going through the boxes, Jared was rummaging in. And it's not even that. You get into a box and there's another box in a box, or you find something in a folder, and then in the folder, there's a folder. And it's just a constant Russian dolls of discovery. And there's, I don't know if that ever ends. Cronon will be able to tell you, but it seems that it doesn't. And that is so exciting. And then to have Jared, and I'm not betraying his generous personal sure. relationship with us by saying that there were very emotional moments as well. And, you know, we all got a bit steamy-eyed thinking that, you know, not romanticizing it, that this was once in the hands of Richard Harris, but that he kept this, he put it somewhere and it meant something to him. And that the family has thought of us as being competent and generous enough to hold and look after it now. So that's answering kind of your question mm-hmm. in a very general way, but I'm selfishly putting in the things that were most exciting about what we just didn't know were there. But the cufflinks is a major thing. But there are loads of little moments, little strands, little annotated comments by Richard on manuscripts he'd written or received. And just they capture a moment in time, but the moment is preserved. And that preservation is, you know, it's a very important word because it gives it longevity and importance forever. And as one of the first things Jared said was when he was asked why donate this at all, he said, because if it stays in storage, it goes beyond them. And when they're all gone, who knows what happens? But the sense that they know it's in good hands and in Irish hands, I think that was an important thing mm. for him.
And I suppose the fact that it's the Munster base as well, which is good.
That was definitely a benefit. But the Munster, the word Munster came up most when he was talking about the rugby.
Yeah.
So it's always good to have a rugby team on your side, you know, and Richard would have approved.
He would indeed. Barry mentioned, you know, the fact that the family trusted you, you as in University College Cork, with this collection, with these prized items. How did that conversation start? Where did all of this start for you?
Well, I suppose we have a long sort of track record in UCC of working with donors and benefactors. You know, as long as I've been in UCC, we've worked very hard, particularly in the library, but also across the university, in building relationships, and relationships don't always end up with collections coming our way or indeed donations coming our way. But, you know, that's not necessarily what's important to us as librarians. We see our role both, you know, as custodians of cultural heritage, but also in a wider network across the country and ensuring that resources in terms of our students, but also heritage artifacts are preserved. So we work very closely in collaboration with members of the public to help them look after their collections, as well as find the best home for collections when they're to be deposited within a public institution. Obviously, public institutions make sure that collections are accessible to the general public. So, yeah, it can be a long process because we have to build trust, and it's a very, very significant gesture for any family, no matter how large or how small a collection, you know, to be handing over personal family material, family documents, you know. And Richard Harris is only, you know, he passed away 20 years ago this week.
That's right.
So it's not a long period of time. And I know, and Barry will understand this as well, you know, how close the family are and how important family was to Richard Harris himself. And I think, you know, when you ask about important things within the collection, you know, that really is a central part of the archive, just mm-hmm. the importance of the family circle. And even in all of the complexities and difficulties of family life, you know, that was the central thing that Richard Harris tried to hold together. It's like, I suppose, and Barry said we got a little bit emotional, and I think that's really, really true, because you have a persona that's presented to you of a film star with a certain sort of ambiance and a kind of, I suppose, very one-dimensional image of someone. And, you know, that's what we all grew up watching on screen, perhaps until we saw, you know, if you were lucky enough to see him on stage, you would probably encounter something completely different. But until we saw the field, we were probably looking at, you know, at Richard Horace from a very specific perspective. But, you know, going through the documentary evidence of the archive, there really is a sense of a very multifaceted character, a very creative character, very determined character, and a very sincere person as well. Like one other Cork reference that I have to mention, and I think it's totally unrecognized and yet exceptionally important. So Horace bought Tower House in London, and Tower House was the house owned by the architect William Burgess, 19th century architect. And William Burgess actually designed St. Finbarr's Cathedral in Cork. So in the library here, we have the plans, the cartoons for the cathedral. We hold them on behalf of the Church of Ireland in UCC here. Richard Horace bought Tower House. Now, I don't know whether it was deliberate, but he set about preserving Tower House. It was essentially derelict. He hired the original builders of Tower House and the original company that were involved in building Tower House. He hired them with his own money and set them about conserving and renovating the house and bringing it back to condition that it could be lived in. And I think about 1971, 72, he sold it to Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin. Mm. Jimmy Page still lives in it today. Now, Jimmy Page is probably the primary collector of William Burgess artifacts, which Burgess designed furniture as well. And he's synonymous with William Burgess. However, Tower House would not exist today without Richard Horace and his efforts to preserve and maintain that building. So you know, it's things like that, that we don't actually realize about him. Like another element, and Barry maybe say a lot more about this than me, but you know, things like his poetry. His poetry is an extensive part of the archive. And, you know, his musical career, you know, again, I'm in the mid-50s, have to admit that. I was too young to really be familiar with Horace as a singer and a performer on stage. And, you know, that is such an important part of his body of work as well. So, you know, getting insights into all of these different elements of his career is really so important.
I want to stay with you, if I can, please, Cronan, because I want to talk about the next phase. I understand the first time that we, the public, will get a chance to see this will be at the Hunt Museum, which is a superb facility in Limerick City. I know that in the information I've seen publicly, it said that the date for that will be announced at another stage. What needs to be done by you and maybe Barry and a few others in University College Cork with the archive or to the archive to present that at the Hunt Museum?
Okay, well, first of all, I'd say that both the Horace family and UCC were determined that the first public experience of the collection would be in Limerick City. It's exceptionally important to everybody concerned. And we're very, very grateful to the Hunt Museum and Jill Cousins in particular in facilitating that opportunity. So I suppose the first thing to say is obviously all of our schedules have been thrown out of sync with the pandemic. So the program that the Hunt would have had is essentially, you know, been delayed by a good 18 months. So we're probably looking at 2024, but possibly 2025. And the reason for that is we want to make the most of the opportunity. We want schools to be involved, and we want the widest range of general public, as well as visitors to Limerick, to have an experience with the Richard Horace Archive. Okay. From a library point of view, we will begin very shortly accessioning the collection. And that's just a formal process where we document all of the artifacts as they arrive with us. Then we will assess the archive for conservation needs and any preparatory work that needs to be done on any item within the collection before it's made publicly accessible. And we will also begin a cataloguing process. And the cataloguing process is quite long. but that will not slow up or delay the exhibition. So, you know, we'll be selecting items from the collection for exhibition purposes at an early stage. And like I know the Hunt has a really innovative approach to exhibitions. So, you know, people that can't make it to Limerick, there will be opportunities to see things online and in a digital context as well. And we'll be thinking about the presentation of artifacts in that context.
Barry, I'll go back to you just on something that Cronon already touched, and I wanted to ask you about it. The image that we all have of Richard Harris will be determined by what we saw on the screen, maybe the theatre, maybe on television during interviews, funny stories that you'll hear people tell about him, maybe his music and that. But you've drilled down into the character or the person. Tell us who Richard Harris was.
Well, that's a bit of a challenge. So I can tell you that there are certain characteristics of the artist, the man, that persist in everything that I've read and experienced and then more recently have discovered through the donation. There is a consistency in an honesty about him. I think he was never afraid to say that he was not confident about a role he was undertaking. He fought for some roles because he believed they were ideal for him and he needed to do them. But he was never insecure enough not to be able to express his own insecurity at given times. He was profoundly confused by what self is, and without getting too existential or philosophical, he was interested in human beings. I think he was deliberately provocative in some instances. I don't think he disrespected anybody intellectually or creatively enough to pander to somebody's opinion or to give way to it or to put his own opinion aside. He was adamant about putting his own opinion on the table and fighting for it, but was equally self-confident is probably the wrong word, but he was equally self-assured in being able to say, all right, put it there, I was wrong. He was interested throughout his whole career in exploring who he was and what it meant to be Richard Harris in a very genuine way. And his very earliest interventions, and this is, we're going back to before his teenage years, into poetry and poetry that has been published. It has this haunting sense of questions of who I am. And these go right through both indirectly roles that he performed and writing that he did to his very later poetry, so that even poetry that he wrote within hours of his death is asking very similar questions. You know, what have I been, you know, what legacy am I leaving behind, and what did I do as a person in the world? So he was an incredibly sensitive but strong person. I mean, rugby, the fact that he started as a rugby player is actually quite significant, because he had that lightness of touch but strength that is often required for in a rugby player, in a lot of sports people, but he had, you know, a wide field of vision. Mm-hmm. He was meticulous in his strategic planning, both in short and medium and long term. And he was strong. He wanted him behind you. You wanted him in front of you, but he was a very reliable go-to person. So all of those things come up, and because of a very unfortunate dose of tuberculosis that he suffered in his late teenage years, which took him off the rugby pitch permanently, it wasn't long before he decided, look, there's something in me that needs me to be performing and on stage. And that might seem a little bit incongruous when you think of somebody who was going to be, you know, a performer of strength strategically on a sports field, to one who is going to be a performer with a different strength on a stage and on the screen. But if anything, if there is an incongruity in those two characters, or in what I or anybody else might perceive as two characters, so much in this archive makes that make sense. You can see, you know, there is something logical about that progression. from one stage, one arena to another.
All right. Gentlemen, I'm not going to delay you much longer, and I appreciate the depth that you've both gone into in relation to this. It's fascinating to listen to. But Cronan, I have to ask, because I'm sitting here in the outskirts of Ennis in County Clare, and about maybe 35 minutes drive from me is a place called Kilkee, which is a wonderful part of the world. And many Limerick people call Kilkee their second home, and Richard Harris was one of those. So I have to ask you, was there anything in the box relating to Kilkee?
There is indeed.
Yeah.
And I just actually had an email inquiry about Kilkee this morning.
All right.
So it's, I'll be honest, I know some of the people who are associated with Harris at Kilkee, but I have a little bit of research to do, I think, in terms of what's in the collection, but I definitely think it'll be a part of the exhibition.
Great.
I know there's some wonderful photographs there. We have to identify some of the people, of course, but it'll certainly be an important part of the exhibition in Limerick.
All righty. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to leave it at that. I do appreciate you taking the time, as I said, and filling us in on it. Is there anything, Barry, about Richard Harris that we haven't touched on that you think would be important to say?
It's really nice to be able to talk about him moving beyond the kind of standard persona that's often put out there, because the depth of who he was is really incredible. And often we put stage and screen public personas into a box and we tie them down. Mm. Well, this is the opening of that box. And it has been a delight. And the idea that this gathering of material is going to be available ultimately for the wider public is so exciting, and I'm delighted that I hope someday they'll be doing that for me. If I ever achieve anything.
I hear you. I think we'd all like. Do you think he'd actually, now that you say that, do you think he'd be embarrassed? Do you think he'd be proud? Do you think he'd be happy about, you know, the fact that his connection with Munster and with Limerick is continuing, and there is going to be a certain amount of adoration attached to this, because, you know, we're only 20 years without him. It was great to be able to see him walk around the streets of Limerick when he used to visit. But how do you think he'd view this whole thing about the collection, you know, being given and the publicity that's going to go around it?
I don't think he'd be embarrassed, and I don't think pride was necessarily a big thing in his life. I think he was very matter-of-fact and very pragmatic. And that base, that strong base, was what let him go to creative, you know, dramatic areas. It's very hard to answer directly for him, so it would be really interesting to hear what Cronan feels about this. But in all of our interactions with Jared and other members of the family, I have consistently taken great assurance from the fact that they are only doing this with us in Ireland, in Munster, because they feel that their dad and granddad would have been happy to do it. So he doesn't have a voice directly on the phone to us anymore, but we've got the next best thing. And that reassurance is incredibly important. So there's no doubt he would have been really, really happy with this. They wouldn't have entrusted anybody without his sanction, albeit unvoiced, because they know him better than anybody else. So I hope that's a faithful representation of our interaction with the family, Cronan.
I would agree. There's nothing I could add there except to say that, again, it comes back to that sense of the Harris family, and I suppose their place in Limerick and in Munster history. And, you know, I think he would have felt very strongly about that. And, you know, again, maybe linking with his search for an understanding of identity. Also, you know, another thing that I think is really important and might be a little bit overlooked is the time that he went to London in the mid-1950s was not a great time if you were Irish abroad. You know, he really was a flag bearer for Irish people abroad, especially in the UK. And all of the challenges that he met in that sort of diaspora experience, I think are very, very important in a broader context for many families across the island. So you know, I think those sort of things are exceptionally important and remain important to the Horace family. They feel a very, very strong connection to Ireland, even though most of them have grown up elsewhere, you know, so...
And you know the way we laugh at each other in Ireland, because when somebody's hanging up, they go bye 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 bye, the long goodbyes. And I'm sorry, this is like a long goodbye here. But I just wanted to ask you, Barry, one question that I forgot, but I should ask you: did you ever meet him?
No, I didn't. No.
Okay.
This is and it, this is just a. It's. Do you know what? It's the flip side of, and this is karma. I in as much as I had the misfortune of never meeting him, it's mere serendipity that I first came in contact with Jared. So so the universe is paying me some some little treat for the fact that I'd never met him. And I've no illusions to this idea that, oh, you should never meet your heroes or you should never. No, if anything, he was as grounded as anybody else, but equally capable of great mystifying performances in real life as much as, you know, fictional ones. So having the voices of the family and chatting with the family and then this wonderful collection, it's just constantly colouring in more information on the complexity that is man and this particular great person.
All right. Barry Monaghan, expert on Richard Harris, thank you so much for that great insight into the man, the character, some of the many characters of him. And Cronan O'Divlin, thank you very much. You're the head of collections at University College Cork, where the Richard Harris archive now resides. Mind it, won't you?
Well, of course.
Look forward to seeing it in the Hunt Museum in a couple of years. Gentlemen, thank you both for your time
today. Thanks a million, Ger. It's lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much, Ger.